So this is a panel about archiving and preserving cultural artifacts generated by the creative uses of the internet and other digital technologies. Can you hear me okay? Cool. We're going to present like a range of approaches and perspectives on archiving and how we go about it and the different means and the methods. And more importantly, we want to situate things like games, websites, virtual worlds, discussion forums, user-generated content, all that kind of stuff that's just produced by the web. We want to present, you know, give it like a cultural context and say, you know, it's more than just the sum of technologies involved in this production, but it's something of cultural relevance, and it's important to keep it and to save it. And aside from places like the Internet Archive, the Internet community as a whole hasn't really done a great job of keeping this stuff. You know, it's always kind of progress and moving forward. But like we said, we think it's worth saving, and we're here to kind of tell you why. So creative uses of the web, what does that mean? We're going to present a couple of approaches. One, like with me in Rhizome, we're going to present internet art. Net art, internet art, any kind of production where the intent behind it was to, you know, was within an art historical context. And it goes back since the beginning of the web. You know, as soon as people could log on and connect to other computers, people were like, I'm going to make art. I'm going to pass around artworks. And we're going to talk about art. So the other thing is virtual worlds and games, spaces where people interact with each other in real time or simulated environments. And even if these are things that run on PCs or whatever, the web certainly enabled their dissemination, their popularity, and they allowed for things like mods and community discussions to kind of work with it. And then the other thing is user-generated content. This is where Jason's going to come in. This is stuff produced by communities online. A lot of times they're, you know, hosted by other larger entities like a Yahoo or a Google or something, and discussion forums, bulletin boards, things like that, and why those are important too and why they're often in jeopardy. So Rhizome. I work for Rhizome. What is Rhizome? It is a nonprofit dedicated to digital art and culture. It was established in 1996. Originally, it was an email listserv started by a guy named Mark Tribe in Berlin. And, you know, the internet was coming around, and it's like I was saying, you know, people were really excited about how there was this new technology, new medium, and how can we make new art for this? So the first thing people did was hit listservs really hard, and they communicated, and they had these groups, these private chats they were sending around. Rhizome started that way. But eventually, we grew into a website and eventually a nonprofit. We are based in the New Museum of Contemporary Art, which is in New York City's Contemporary Art Museum. We are our own independent organization within the New Museum, but we also help them with some media art, contemporary art, curation, and things like that. The art base is Rhizome's Archive of Digital Art. We do a lot of other things. We have publications. We're an online platform for artists to discuss stuff. We do events and programming in the city. But for now, I'm going to talk about the art base, which is our archive. It was established in 1999, but the artworks we do have go back even earlier than that. We do two things. We create records of artworks so that people can, you know, have metadata about them, and we also preserve them. So we have like 2,500 artworks, records in the system, and we have over 500 artworks that are actually running on our servers that are available for access for people to check out. A little quickly about our process. When we're going to archive a work, we, you know, work with the artist to get the files, and then we check them to see if they're compatible to browsers. You know, obviously older artworks can't, or, you know, they have old code that doesn't have contemporary compatibility. So what we'll do is we'll take the original artwork, see if it still runs. If it doesn't, we'll clone it, zip up the original code because we want to keep that for something, you know, to look at later on. And then we'll bring it up to modern browser compatibility standards, put it on our servers, and make it available online for people at any point. So I'm going to show a couple of artworks that we have in our archive that have been we've collected over the past 15, 20 years, just to kind of give you a range of what we're going on. The first one is Little Movies. It's by a theorist and a pretty well-known guy named Lev Manovich. Dates back to 1994, but it was a project that went for a couple years. I was actually did some work on it this summer. I was kind of casual around, found some things missing, reached out to Lev, and he was like, missing some assets, and I found some other assets and put them together. So now we have like the only kind of working copy that's online. So this project, you know, it's really interesting. It's kind of you know, it reminds me of the McLuhan adage, like the content of any new medium is the old medium. So like what Lev was trying to do is like, what's cinema like online? What does it mean to watch movies online? Each one of these files, these little movies you watch, they're small, you know, little pixel boxes. They're about 1.1 megabytes. It takes, if you're in 1996 and you're watching, you're trying to watch this thing, it's going to take a little while to get it. So it was about creating an aesthetics of bandwidth, like what is the aesthetics of limited bandwidth? What does this do to the experience of watching movies? Is it possible to have these kind of meaningful things? And of course, as the technology evolves, now these things load quickly and you can watch them. But it was a really kind of interesting work that kind of, there's a lot, you know, it's kind of talking about the technologies and how media's change. So the next one I want to talk about is it's a webcam by an artist named Petra Courtwright. It was 2007, so we're jumping into the future a little bit. This is an artwork in which the artist, she's capturing a web camera of herself, and she's kind of scrolling through the default effects that are come with her, like her brand new webcam, and they're kind of these cheesy, like you know, lightning, pizzas, palm trees, all these kind of like default effects that come with webcams, and she's just kind of nonchalantly going through them, and this is put on YouTube, and it's kind of a commentary about how we consume video online as well, like the other one. This was on YouTube, and it had about 200 or more tags with it, ranging from like mundane things to obscene things, and last year YouTube took it down because it violated their spaminess, levels or whatever. So the artist used YouTube to present this work, and it was, you know, she had it embedded on her website presenting it. So when YouTube took it down, it was gone. Luckily, we had it still, and you know, the context has changed, but you know, it's still on our site, so you can go and see the original thing. And this was also, I mean, this was a work that was pretty well documented. It was, you know, taught in universities. It was kind of like in a pretty major piece. So it's an interesting tension there with this presentation and this disappearing. The other work, the last one I want to show, is called The Deleted City. This is a work in which this is actually inspired by Jason's, what he's done with the archive stuff. Basically, the artist wrote a processing app that took GeoCities, the huge GeoCities torrent, and visualized it and put it on, you know, it's obviously not a web work. It is an interactive kind of media work. But as you go through the old the archive, it kind of, if you remember, GeoCities was broken up into locations and places and cities and things like that. So it's kind of an interactive way for you to go through these things and see them visualized, you know, by a touch screen. If there were MIDI files associated, you know, with the website, the MIDI files will play. So it's kind of an interest, like, you know, it's taking this old kind of online space and kind of representing it in our new, you know, with like a new interface. Go through this. So I'm Nick Hasty. That's Rhizome, is kind of what we do. I want to make sure that we have time for questions and stuff later on, so I'm going to move it on to Carrie.
And, okay, that's working. Good. So part of what I do at the University of Maryland is preserve video games in 3D virtual worlds. This slide is courtesy of my colleague and collaborator, Jerry McDonough at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. I've been involved in two projects where this has been our mandate. The first one was funded by the Library of Congress, and I'm hoping that some of my Library of Congress friends are in the room. And we adopted a case set approach. So we were trying to figure out how to actually archive a set of 8 different video games. And these really ran the gamut, included a number of works of early interactive fiction, such as Colossal Cave Adventure, which is the first documented work of interactive fiction, Mystery House, which is the first work of interactive fiction with graphics, a host of other games, Space War, which dates to 1962 and was played on a PDP-1, and also Second Life, the 3D virtual world Second Life. Now, we did not archive all of Second Life. We chose a few key islands to work with, and that part of our work was largely a disaster, I have to say. It proved to be incredibly complicated to do. I'd be happy to talk about that some more during the Q&A. We have a book-length white paper that's available free as a download. If you Google for Preserving Virtual World's Final Report, you can download the PDF. The other project is ongoing. This is funded by the Institute of Museum and Library Services. Our case set this time is mostly educational games, mostly but not entirely. It's hard to make a case that Doom is an educational game. But we do have Oregon Trail in there, Typing of the Dead, also a fun one, and Carmen Sandiego, and some others. In this case, in the first project, we were actually trying to ingest institutional bits into repositories. We actually, at the end of the day, we have game bits at the University of Stanford and the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. This project is more research-oriented. Our premise is you can't save all the features of every game or every piece of complex interactive software. You're going to lose information. Can we try to determine what the most salient features or attributes of these game sets are and adopt preservation strategies long-term that ensure at least those properties remain intact, even if we lose some others? This has proven to be incredibly difficult, not least because when archivists talk about significant properties, they're mostly referring to surface attributes or features, not underlying data structures. And often when we're trying to preserve video games, because they're proprietary, we don't have access to things like source code. So this is this has proven to be enormously challenging. Jason Scott is actually on our advisory board for that project. So in summer 2011, I wrote an op-ed for the New York Times on digital preservation. I got scores of emails, and there were two predominant responses. One was a lot of people, who were furious about the fact that I treated data as a singular noun instead of a plural noun. So the title of the piece was "When Data Disappears" instead of "When Data Disappear." And boy, did I hear about this. The venom that poured into my inbox was extraordinary. But the second piece of email that I got in large volumes was far more positive. And it was the attention that I showed to gamers, the role of gamers in digital preservation. They used the phrase curatorial activism. I use the phrase curatorial activism to describe that. So in the remainder of my time, I really want to highlight the role of gamers to show what they're doing. There was a recent piece, an op-ed in PC World, that looked at the role of gamers in terms of piracy and preservation, but what they do goes far, far beyond that. So if this slide looks familiar, it's you might have seen it in Jane McGonigal's 2000 TED Talk. It's by this artist named Phil Toledo, who took these photographic portraits of gamers while they were playing games. And Jane McGonigal called this portrait as someone on the verge of an epic win. So gamers save bits. In her 2011 book, Reality is Broken, Why Games Make Us Better and How They Can Change the World, veteran game designer Jay McGonigal argues that far from jeopardizing our future, as author Mark Bauerlein would have it, video and massively multiplayer online games have the potential to help us solve some of the world's most pressing challenges, from energy crises to climate change to global hunger. Game design isn't just technological craft, she says. It's a 21st century way of collaborating, thinking, problem solving, and changing attitudes and behavior. As a proof of concept, McGonigal has spent the last several years developing and implementing a number of highly influential alternate reality games, including World Without Oil, Superstruct, and Evoke, whose collective purpose is to arrive at, quote, creative solutions to some of our most urgent social problems through planetary scale collaboration. Although the games have spawned a gripping counterfactual record of convincing antidotes to and scenarios of near future epidemics and calamities, none of them, McGonigal has remarked, referring to the entire universe of MMO and video games, not just her own, have saved the real world yet. Or have they? Let me answer that question first by pointing to a deceptively mundane-looking piece of hardware. Oh, I'll come back to that one, actually. A deceptively mundane piece of hardware called a cryoflux, and that's actually what you're seeing in this slide right here. It was designed to read and image bitstream stored on obsolete magnetic media, such as 3.5-inch or 5.25-inch floppy disks. Although content agnostic, this ingenious device was developed by game enthusiasts with a single purpose in mind: to rescue 1980s-era games originally played on the Commodore 64, the Amiga, and other vintage machines. It is now an integral part of professional archivist toolkits around North America and Europe. So a device created by gamers, this crazy piece of hardware, you can kind of see, actually what you don't see here is the host PC that the CryoFlux is hooked up to via this USB cable. But it essentially allows you to bypass or circumvent the original computer system or platform. So it's really kind of an extraordinary tool that, again, a number of professional archivists are now using, again, created by gamers. So one point I want to make here is that we can learn a lot from gamers in terms of curatorial and archival approaches. So part of what they do is very much about this kind of DIY maker mentality. Even though what they produce for digital preservation is instrumental and practical in nature, hardware that we use, emulators that we use, metadata that we use, that the way in which they do it is often incredibly playful, exploratory, and experimental. And alongside the instrumental products they produce are also often a number of crazy and playful ones, like, you know, a Commodore 64 that's reimagined as a laptop. I'm thinking of Ben Heckendorn. Or a Xbox 360 game controller that's shoehorned inside an Atari 2600 game controller, that sort of thing. So, in its broad strokes, the trajectory of these curatorial activists, from video game enthusiasts to programmer hobbyists to dedicated digital preservationists, is recapitulated in the trajectories of countless numbers of players who, over the last two decades or more, have been modeling community-driven practices and solutions to collecting, documenting, accessing, and rendering video games, arguably the most culturally resonant digital artifacts of our time. There's no shortage of preservation challenges with which to contend. Bit rot, the scourge of technological obsolescence, the parasitic reliance of software programs on code libraries supplied by the operating system and other software packages, and the growing number of digital collections sitting on shifting foundations of silicon, rust, and plastic, as one writer has ominously expressed it. Complex interactive computer games represent the limit case of what we can do with digital preservation. If we can figure out how to keep a classic first-person shooter like Doom alive, we'll have a better idea of how to preserve computational simulations of genetic evolution, climate change, or the galactic behavior of star systems. Just as importantly, we'll also have the technical and social knowledge to maintain the billions of everyday electronic records, emails, memos, still images, sound files, videos, e-books, instant messages that constitute the collective memory of our civilization. To speak of the contribution of gamers exclusively in the future tense, however, is to fail to do justice to the scope and ingenuity of their accomplishments thus far. Quote, the internet is populated with legions of amateur digital archivists, archaeologists, and resurrectionists, wrote Stuart Brand of the Long Now Foundation more than a decade ago. He went on to elaborate. They tracked down the original code for lost treasures such as Space Invaders, Pac-Man, and Frogger, and they collaborate on devising emulation software that lets the primordial programs play on contemporary machines. The techniques pioneered by these vernacular programmers are at present the most promising path to a long-term platform migration solution. Such massively distributed research can convene enormous power. It's no accident that this tribute by Brand to the heroic efforts of the player community comes at the conclusion of a chapter entitled Ending the Digital Dark Ages. For Brand, video games serve as a skeleton key for unlocking the complexities of digital preservation, empowering us to prevent an epochal digital black hole. The import of his message is clear. For love of Space Invaders and bonus fruits, of rescuing the girl and fighting and defeating the boss, for love of treasure, power-ups, and sprites, for love of all these things, players have been inspired to save our video game inheritance. But in the process of salvaging these fragile 8-bit worlds, they've also helped save some of the real world. Like the technology trees found in popular strategy games, where the acquisition of one technology is dependent on that of another, the solution to any of the super threats conjured by Jane McGonigal, from pandemics to fuel shortages to mass exile, is predicated on methods for reliably transmitting legacies of knowledge from one generation to the next. When those legacies are encoded as bit streams, it is video game players who have been in the vanguard of figuring out how to do it, bolstering McGonnell's assertion that gamers are a precious human resource that we can use to do real-world work. Games can save the world, McGonagall emphatically tells us. Jane, they already have. And I'll pass the mic to Jason now.
Oh, you don't have to do that.
Hi, everyone.
Does this thing go on? How about now? How about now? Like it needs it, huh? Hi, everyone. How many people here know who I am? Have heard of me before? All right, good. That's a good set. The rest of you are going to get a nice big lesson in life. Hello. Go back to the first one. Oh, what? Oh, you took off one of my slides? I love you, Nick. I love you. Hi, I'm Jason Scott. I am a historian and archivist. I'm an activist. I'm a preservationist. I'm a loudspeaker. I am someone based off emotion. I am based off of thought, action, reaction, because I think that's much more important than giving people a bunch of words up on a screen. So, what am I here for? I'm here because when I was very young, I discovered I was an archivist. How did that happen? This is actually not on, by the way. Just so you know. I mean, trivia. Yeah, there we go. I just want to get a recording. By the way, just so you know, I'm recording this whole thing right over here because I don't trust anybody. I've actually got my own recording. Anyway, the way I know I became an archivist was when I was about 9, when I was woken up in the middle of the night by my mother, who had decided that she had to leave the house we were in as soon as possible, and which resulted in a divorce. This caused me to have to determine what exactly is the actual context of my life. It turns out it's a blanket and a dog and a pillow. And so in a very short period of time, I had to rearrange the things in my life to accommodate this new mobile lifestyle. I went to a bunch of different schools, ended up in some nice ones and some not so nice ones. And in that way, I learned that nothing is permanent. Nothing is definite. We get too locked up in looking at the way things are right now, where we have all of these seats aimed this way. And we say to ourselves, oh, surely this is the way it's always been. And this is the way our conference has to work. That's not true. Shaking up paradigms is the way to go about it. And what I do is I try to point out to people that right now we have all these things going on, even in this particular convention center, people talking, people interacting. There are 20 other tracks going on right now of varying quality, but we don't get to go to them because we've made a choice to go watch this guy. And the thing is that all of those might have value. And the thing is we're in a beautiful technological sphere right now where we can pull in all of these materials. At the same time, we can easily lose them. Can I go to Act Two? Some time ago, I joined the Internet Archive, which I really like to stress is such a beautiful place, not as crazy as I am, but still dedicated to saving things. A lot of people think of the Internet Archive for its Wayback Machine. That's wayback.archive.org, a way you can look back at the web for the last 15 years. If you see a website and you want to know what it was like 10 years ago, they were on it. They're a nonprofit library. I encourage you to look at their other works, though. If you go to archive.org, there are thousands of movies, thousands of books, thousands of podcasts, things saved from all over the world that they're trying to rescue. Because in today's world, we like to think about the now as opposed to what was the was. And anytime you see something that's perhaps older than a human span, that is a contributed set of people holding hands through time, agreeing not to destroy it. And I think that we, you know, get way too hung up on the now and forgetting that somebody could value from what we have going forward. And when I joined up with the Internet Archive, it was because of another project I was working on called Archive Team, totally separate. Having watched the death of things like Tripod, what eventually became GeoCities, I said, we need a team of people who are dedicated to saving items. And we created something called the Archive Team. That's at archiveteam.org. I think that a speech is mostly a set of links that I give you that you go to later. So archiveteam.org, it's a rogue band of archivists. We've been downloading things, whether they want it or not, for some time. GeoCities announced that they were closing in 60 days. We downloaded a lot of it. We put it up as a torrent on the Pirate Bay. Why? Well, we just felt like this was a 15-year human anthropological study, a chance for people to speak with a greater audience than perhaps their entire genetic line had spoken. This snapshot of us going online and becoming what we are now, so connected, that was in danger of being lost simply because somebody wanted to move something from column A to column B. Right now, Gowalla just shut down. All of that history is gone. Okay, Gowalla's gone. Just check your app. It's gone. Fortune Cities announcing they're closing within the next 60 days. These are places that offered people to come and bring themselves on, and they're giving them, after 10 years, after 12 years, 60 days to get their act together, find a new place, or just walk away from it. And we felt like, just like any discussion about the preservation of a building ends once they knock the building down, we felt like saving the data first, asking questions later, has worked out for us. Third act. So I want people to understand that when you look at something like Archive Team, it's something that's built off of volunteers with a belief. Now, you may not share all those beliefs, but I would like at least for you to be aware that if you are somebody who is involved in something involving data, people's data, user-contented data, even though the laws don't permit it and don't endorse this, you are a caretaker of people's lives. I understand that makes your lawyer freak out, but people are trusting you with data. And the easiest way for you in those early days when you were on the folding table trying to make $1 million is to add an export function as fast as you added that import function for people to be able to pull what they have off. If you're good, it doesn't matter. If you're uninteresting, they were going to leave anyway. But by making the data exportable, you're part of the conversation instead of trying to be the end of it to make extra money. If you walk away from nothing else today, and you shouldn't because Nick is awesome, you should definitely please add an export function and think about shutdown, because shutdown does happen. It happens to all of us. Act CODA. You know, we're all going in the ground, and I'm sorry to break that to you, but if you think of your life as when you go in the ground, then I think you failed. If you think of your life as what you've done and how others can learn from you and what you've learned, you'll do a lot better. And it goes the same for our data. Our data is rapidly becoming us. We are becoming part of a large hive mind that is sharing data. If somebody slaps somebody in the line at a grocery, we all know about it now, right? We all yell because that happened. If somebody mistreats their partner, we hear about it, right? This is where we are now. Sorry to tell you, hive mind, you're a bee. It's okay. Being a bee is cool. But part of the advantage of being that is that we can all benefit very quickly. Places like Stack Exchange, places like Wikipedia even, can provide us with a way to share information with each other and get better, faster, quicker, solve problems that previously would just dominate thought for years on end in minutes. And I think that's a miracle. But along with that, like I said, comes this idea of preserving what we've done. And I think that conversation doesn't happen because we're too focused on the start. We're going to do this. We're going to do this forever. It's going to be awesome. And unfortunately, life has proven that not to be the case. So my name again, Jason Scott. Let's go to the last one here, is basically what I just want to ask you is, I love talking about this stuff, and I love pointing people to projects. You don't even have to talk to me that long. I'll give you links. And all I want to do is a few minds in here, wandering in here, not quite sure what they were going to see, look what you found, and I'm just saying, maybe take advantage of that. I would really appreciate it. Let's try to make this world a better place, one disk drive at a time. Thanks.
So we're going to just have a little brief discussion about one topic that we were all kind of interested in ourselves and kind of speaks to our work. But then I want to open it up to questions for us to – you can throw stuff at us and kind of see what we think about it. So in each – the question is for us is like in each one of our archival practices, we've kind of dealt with the friction between – you know, like with creative content being hosted online, and a lot of times it's hosted by a larger entity you know, that controls the means of dissemination or exposure, where it's a YouTube or a Yahoo or a, you know, like ID software or something like that. And, you know, they kind of make, they have control over the long term, you know, the life of this thing, and they make decisions that can jeopardize this stuff. On the flip side of that is we have, you know, nonprofits like the Internet Archive and Rhizome and universities and things like that that are working to preserve this stuff, but, you know, there's very limited resources and all that. I mean, if I've read that Kickstarter has basically gave out as much money or is planning to give out as much money this year as the National Endowment for the Arts for the entire U.S. So there's this, you know, we can only do so much ourselves. I want to just talk about, you know, what are other people doing? Obviously, Jason's an example of this. What are people doing in the gaming community? And what's the context of that? Like, what's what are the implications of, like, for, I know for art, it's very different. And, you know, the instability and the tension between both of these two things. If we can't rely on these other ones, you know, what needs to change? And how can we circumvent it? So, Carrie, do you want to open up?
Yeah, sure. So, So one of the things Jason does is he goes and gets bits from places like GeoCities that are shutting down, where these third-party service providers, with very little warning, tell their users that they're about to lose all of their stuff. And so we tend to look, especially if you're in the cultural heritage sector or the nonprofit sector, we tend to look at these for-profit companies as only as a slight exaggeration as the villain. But when I published an op-ed about digital preservation, Bruce Sterling was one of the people who replied. He has donated a lot of his papers to the University of Texas Ransom Center. So right here in Austin, this is where Bruce Sterling, the science fiction writer Bruce Sterling's papers are. And he didn't include any electronic papers, any electronic records, any electronic materials. And it's because he thinks that digital preservation is a fool's errand, that it's in you know, we're working with inherently unstable storage media and conditions. And in response to my piece, he said, "I used to worry about the floppy disks. Now I worry about the universities." And what he meant by that is that the constant migration we need to perform to sort of outrun the short lifespans of the media that we use to store our bits necessitates a constant budget. And he sees what's happening in the larger political climate, where increasingly higher education is under attack, funding for higher education is under attack, museums are receiving less funding, and so forth, and he doesn't think that the project is sustainable. He doesn't think that universities can do the job. So I do think we're in this kind of scary era where, on the one hand, we're kind of aware of the precarious nature of our stuff that's stored on the cloud. I think increasingly we're aware of that. But we do tend to think of museums, archives, and our universities as long-term, stable institutions and environments. And I think Bruce Sterling is spot on when he questions that assumption. I don't entirely know what the answer is. I think increasingly you will see us having to rely on innovative services like Kickstarter, and Jason demonstrates that really well. What's interesting is that we'll need to evolve whole new skill sets to do that. You can't be a kind of diffident, shy person and do Kickstarter well. So when I think about, I work in an information school, so I think about training the next generation of archivists, and I think we're going to have to develop entirely new skill sets.
Cool. I'll speak. So in the art world, I don't want to represent the entire capital A art world, but from the world of internet art, it's kind of a different situation because these are things like internet artwork, especially like Petra's video that was on YouTube. That artwork is bound into the context and when it's shown. You know, some artists may not care. It could be a video that shows anywhere. But for her work, you know, YouTube is a part of the context of the work, and the terrible comments and the bad obscene stuff and all the recommendations. Like, it's an artwork that's about how we look at YouTube and how we consume media. So it's, you know, it's one thing that we can say, oh, we got a backup of it, but it doesn't really, you know, it doesn't really speak to the long term, like the context of it. And there's things like emulation and things like that, but you can't, certainly we can't, you know, run YouTube on us. So it's kind of a different, on Rhizome servers for sure. So it's kind of a different flip side of the thing where we need, you know, and I don't expect YouTube to be sensitive to these things necessarily. They have a lot of stuff to worry about. But it is a different kind of interesting perspective where, you know, what these things are, what they're hosted on, is part of it's wrapped up into it. But they're, you know, we do what we can. And also, you know, newer artists or younger artists where, like, the internet is just kind of bound up into their practice in general. Like, it's not so much of a niche thing anymore. It's like people who are in their 20s and they're making art. Like, the internet's just, it's just given. Like, that's just like a thing. You know, they're a little more savvy, and, you know, there's abundant storage, and they're easy to keep their stuff up online and available, and some of them, if they're developers, they use things like GitHub and things like that. So it's kind of, you know, it's out there and in the cloud, and we can get a copy of it, and store it the best we can. But the real stuff that we have trouble with is things that were created 15 to 20 years ago when artists, you know, had a host and the hosting provider and they had it up there and that hosting provider is dead, you know, is gone. And they may not have backed it up because it was, they didn't really understand. Or maybe they didn't understand, but, you know, maybe they moved to a different house and they lost their hard drive. So it's kind of the older stuff that we're, that we kind of work on now, the earlier internet art stuff. We do, you know, archive new stuff and we do bring in new stuff. We're always developing it, but we have a special place for things that are older. Because a lot of the things, especially that have really established the genre itself, like the old stuff, the net.art, it comes from supposedly a garbled email that was sent out between two artists. And, you know, they were looking through, trying to make sense of it, and they just saw the net.art, and they're like, oh, okay, that's what we're doing. Because, you know, the medium immediately just kind of screwed it up. The guy who, you know, kind of coined that, Vuk Kosek, even I think his, some of his works are lost. You know, even they were housed by other institutions, other museums, his own personal collection, you know, they're gone. And it's an important time that should be findable and should be browsable and should be seen these things. So that's why we kind of emphasize access, modifications if need be, and just to keep it up so people can go back and kind of like look at this stuff. This, a lot of it's really interesting. Thank you, Jason.
All right. Let's make this interactive. I'm going to shout some tags. You're going to raise your hand when you are that tag, okay? Technical. Political. Activist. Loving. Emotional. Angry. Entrepreneur. Reporter. Put your hands down. You should never do that. Be an observer. Don't be an action person. So the thing is I'll just quickly mention a technical story here with some aspects of why we fight for this kind of thing. Because it's a real-world example, and I'm big on real-world examples. So the Cray. Everyone here know the Cray? Ever heard of this thing? It's a Cray supercomputer. It's the world's most expensive love seat. Beautiful piece of work, okay? Unbelievable thing. You can now run it on a laptop. It's not that big anymore, but it was a big deal. And there was a guy named Chris, lives in New York, and he got his hands on a disk pack. This is the late 1970s, early 1980s disk pack. It's about this big, okay? And here's the thing. He wanted the data off of it, but however, everything associated with it was dead. There's nowhere to read this disk pack. Now, the archivists and the institutionalists and other people will say, this is a tragedy, and this is what we have to fight against. The people who are already dead inside will say, it doesn't matter anyway. What does it matter? This is old Cray stuff. We know there was a Cray. We're done. The technical people will say, this is a problem I need to solve. The activist will say, we need to find out first what's on here before we dismiss it, and we have to tell everybody to help us. A conflagration of all these things came together, and what he ended up doing at a university for his project was he wrote an Arduino-guided magnet that would go over the disk, read its data. This 128-megabyte disk resulted in a 20-gigabyte image, which was the magnetic flux recording. Then there was a concern that there was no place to host this for people to check it out. That's where I got told about it, and people said, let's go to Jason Scott. He's Mr. Disk anyway. So they contacted me, and I put it up on the Internet Archive, and I put it on the Internet Archive blog that we had a 20-gigabyte magnetic flux image of a Cray disk, and you're like, okay. And we said, can anyone help us get the data off it and read what this thing is and figure out its format? That took 48 hours. Guy in Norway read about it, went up there, sent him all the data. Then we had somebody in Australia who turned out had been sent a disk pack as well from Cray in the 1980s for localization, which happened to have all their stuff because they wanted it to say shrimp on the Barbie during the OS, and they ended up keeping it. They flew it to New York, I mean in the lap of somebody, sat with this disk pack in his lap, brought it to Chris and read it off too. There we see a whole bunch of different forces, and I think negativity was not needed at any point in that. I think saying, is this worth keeping? Is this worth doing? This isn't a discussion. This seems like a rant. But anyway, the point is, I want people to think about you know, all these different forces that came in there. And at no point did somebody say, this isn't worth doing, let's stop this now and actively try to stop them. I think we do too much of that. I think we let the cop in our head tell us what to do instead of letting the actual cop stop us. So anyway, can we get somebody to discuss with us? Is there somebody who has something they want to discuss? You. Yes.
So, I love what all you guys do. It seems like there's sort of two different approaches here. So Rhizome and the university projects, you guys are selecting specific works of art, specific titles that have been released as games, and selecting them for a curatorial process and for an archival process that you guys already sort of have a framework for. At the same time, the Internet Archive has this completely different approach where you guys are constantly just downloading tons and tons of data.
Yes.
I was wondering, are there any ideas for how those two approaches might be merged together to create sort of dynamic processes, automated processes that are downloading stuff, but at the same time sifting through them in some way to make them more easily readable to someone like me who doesn't necessarily have the time to look through the entire Internet Archive, but is interested?
I do have to say that I am contractually obligated not to speak for the Internet Archive. That said, a lot of librarians and archivists are taxidermists. The archive is capturing fireflies. It's a very different approach because they're going after things, with exceptions of newer items, but they're looking at things for a certain degree of life. Doom's been around for even 15, 20 years. But we're talking about websites that are literally up for an average of 6 months with changes that are consistent. So very different that way. But I will say, as an objective observer of the Internet Archive, they really do reach out to libraries. They host conferences. They really interact with the Library of Congress, with various universities, to really make sure that what they produce is of use to other groups. So they designed something called the WARC format, which unfortunately does not have much provenance, or people aren't really aware of it. Web Archive. It's a format to allow long-term storage of web pages. The archive team was like, not enough people know about this. So we hammered on the GNU wget project, and the next version of GNU wget will support WARC in parallel. So it will use it in something that a nerd would want and then something that an archivist would want, allowing them to store it forever in this other format. Similarly, all sorts of things involving metadata and taxonomy, everything tries to be flexible along that way. The biggest problem is that it's a technically oriented group that has just not enough funding for the 200 to 300 unhappy post-grad students who are going to sit there and classify the stuff. Mm-hmm. So one thing we try to do is absorb other classified items and work with them. So, you know, give you an example of ephemerality. I just acquired at the Internet Archive 10,000 shows of 10,000 hours of 3,000 shows at the DNA Lounge in San Francisco. Okay? This is many hours, right? And I'm using their own event calendar as its taxonomy, which means it's all based off of what their impression of their item is. And it could be completely different what's on the tape. Tape, he said. I put that up there, and people are benefiting from it on both a emotional basis, but there are also ways to kind of search what bands are in there. And what my hope is to leave things open and reduce the friction for outside groups, perhaps not with this often clusterfuck of a wiki that we end up with in this world, but something where people can feel gradiated down that their work is getting instantaneous reaction. As bad as it is, the IMDb is actually a rather good example of this. They could use a few more revisions. But they have a semi-friction, but what you do put in is very high quality and will come out again. So, I mean, you know, it is on the minds of the archive, and they've tried to make contingency for it. And my hope is that by spreading the word that this thing exists, that people will say, oh, I actually had a guy come to me and say, yeah, I'm out of work, and I normally do curation. Can I just do metadata for a while for you? He was an out of work, looking for will metadata for fun guy. I need 6,000 of them. And the problem solves itself. My hope is that those 6,000 are sitting now, right now, watching TV, waiting for the word to start up. That's the hope. Any other thoughts? People I dominated over? Sorry.
I mean, for us, it's a fairly young field. So the problems that we face is, you know, number one, like, there's a curatorial aspect to what we're doing, and then there's limited resources to what we do have. What we can actually archive and what we can actually run to our best of our abilities. We have people who submit artworks to us. Like, we definitely have curators and people who, you know, a great team of people who are aware of what's going on, who are looking for stuff and selecting things. But we also have people who tell us, like, hey, we're making art. Look at my art. Like, consider it. Because, you know, we live in a world where there's a lot of information. People are everyone's a creator, and it's fantastic. And I'm not saying we're trying to write a history of what's good and bad, but there is, you know, art history is a thing. People go to school and they get specialized in it, and the people that we work kind of like deal with that. And there are other startups like Artsy and things like that that have whole teams of just like people with art history backgrounds who are classifying, you know, work. And we kind of want to do that approach too. So it's an issue of metadata for us. It's like, what can we take in? Can we get people who can really describe it and make it something meaningful for people to come and like say, you know, what the hell is net art? Or like, what is glitch aesthetic? Like, what does that even mean? Like, we need someone who kind of can like phrase that, who has a good historical knowledge, a technical knowledge, which is a rare, you know, it's not a whole lot of people. It's growing, but it's not a whole lot historically. So we needed like those people who actually get in, get in our system, describe the work. And then, you know, if we can archive it, we can archive it. Otherwise, we bring it in. But yeah, and I think, you know, Rhizome used to be more, I mean, people say that we were more open, and it was just this kind of, you know, it was a listserv, and it was chaotic, and it kind of, like, you know, it was ossified into this kind of, like, the man. Like, we're a super small organization, but we're often kind of thought of as, like, the man in the scene or whatever, which is funny. But it is one of those things where, you know, we want to make this something that's accessible, and it's part of a larger discussion about art and creativity. You know, internet art has always been extremely niche, like, but we feel that, you know, this is contemporary art. This is what people, you know, this is where it's coming from. It was very technical in the past, or, you know, very about internet and aesthetics and that kind of stuff. But now it's just like it's coming a contemporary art thing. And we want to, you know, kind of push that forward and introduce this new aesthetics into the world.
I would just say in response that the projects I've worked on at the University of Maryland with other institutional partners is a little bit different from what Nick does. That we actually chose our case sets not because we've determined, you know, it's not about actually curating the games with the intrinsic merit, you know, Space War is of more value than Pac-Man or whatever. Rather, with Preserving Virtual Worlds 1, our question was, what does it even mean to say you're preserving at all these interactive objects? And so we were basically in an experimental and scoping phase, and we were just trying things out. What are the boundary objects of some of these games? What else do you need to save alongside the game bits themselves? Representational information, for example. So Mystery House, work of interactive fiction that ran on the Apple II. The representational information that you need for a future user group to interact with that game is going to be, among other things, the Apple II DOS manual. So that becomes part of your information package in terms of what you're actually ingesting into a repository. And then if that Apple II DOS manual is in its saved in, say, PDF format, it becomes infinitely recursive, because then you've got to save the PDF specification so that Apple II DOS manual in turn is accessible in the future. Ultimately, the paradox is that that infinite regression means that you're ultimately relying on paper copies somewhere. So we haven't worked out some of those details yet. So that's a little bit different than what Nick does at Rhizome. I love the question. Who was it at? I love the question. If you have ideas, talk to us out afterwards. I think a lot of what we do at universities and archives doesn't scale at all. And I do think that you need someone with Jason's talents that can really crowdsource a lot. And I know that the Internet Archive does work closely with museums and universities. They've got their Archive It program, for example, and a lot of member institutions. I don't know if Rhizome subscribes to that or not, but a lot of museums and archives and universities do.
I got a question from my girlfriend. She's an internet archivist in Amsterdam, the Netherlands. Yeah. She was wondering what is the most endangered species of digital media, like the nitrate movies of digital media.
The what movies?
The nitrate films, nitrate, you know, because movies. It all blows up because it's a very, very dangerous material. Mm-hmm.
Things that people think are being recorded and aren't. That's what I mean. When people are misled to think that something's being recorded, we have no idea what South by Southwest is going to do with this recording. We have no idea when we go into a podcast with somebody if that person has made any contingencies for long-term preservation. And we certainly don't have any indication that Facebook is doing a fucking thing for presentation, right? For you know, what I tell people is we believe that Google is an archive. But Google is an archive or a library like a supermarket is a food museum. All right? And the thing is that there's this inherent trust that just because big data means permanent data. And I think that's our biggest risk is that we end up doing things like depending on concepts like the cloud or the concept of shared hosting and then waking up one day and we've got a big bag of flowers and there's no gold coins in it. Right?
Yeah, but any others too?
Yeah, for us, since the majority of what we do is web-based, it's an issue of whether the artwork is created using like a proprietary system like Flash or something versus whether they create something with just W3 certified standards. So if an artist hands over an artwork from 1994 and it's HTML, you can plop it in and it works. You know what I mean? Or CSS or, you know, if the JavaScript like is a little funky, we have to go in there and say, okay, don't, you know, sniff for Netscape. We don't have to worry about that anymore. But it's like fairly easy to update. But if it's something where it's like a really old version of Flash or QuickTime or something like that, and we're just like, oh, you know, who's going to like open up this object? You know, do you remember the old ActionScript? Like, I'm not an ActionScript programmer. It's like, so we have to like, you know, those are like, well, we'll just put this one on the side, put it on the back burner, save it. We can deal with it later. What can we reasonably deal with and make accessible now?
They shut up pretty quick. Hey, Smiley, right there. Yeah, yeah.
There was a talk earlier today about the right to be forgotten and about a lot of user-generated content where things stick around and maybe people don't want them to. Mm-hmm. And maybe that even chills us from speaking in the first place. I'm curious what you archivists think about. What about people who want that content to disappear?
I'm not going to waste your time saying what I want to say, so let the other two talk.
So let me first say that I'm not an archivist. I'm a scholar who preserves games. So I'm not sure an archivist would answer this in the same way. But I will say this. What we often think of the function of archivists as saving everything. But in fact, part of their jobs involves deaccessioning materials and disposing of them. It's sort of like one of the guilty secrets of the archival world. Precisely because not everything can be saved, so I don't disagree at all. I don't think it's really that controversial. That well, maybe my other panelists would have a different perspective on that. I will say that I think part of the challenge is that we have to work hard to ensure that future generations, posterity, cares about what we save. And I think in many instances, dumping bits in a dark archive that remains inaccessible for decades is one of the worst things we can do. There's a great novel that was published by an Austin native last spring, Ernest Cline, Ready Player One. That book is all about the gamification of digital preservation, but it's largely about how do you motivate future generations to care about the same things that you care about. There's a wealthy individual who leaves his fortune in this novel to future generations who can solve a series of quests, game quests. And so the entire culture is heavily invested in 1980s era game culture as a result. So I think allowing our bits and our content to be reused and in many cases transformed can actually be valuable.
For us, our rule of thumb is we usually talk to the artist, and you know, we've gone up to like some pretty seminal people and be like, "Hey, we want to archive your stuff," and they're like, "No," and we're like, "Okay, that's fine." You know, are there some people who are like, "Hey, this thing's broken. We're gonna fix it," and they're just like, "Don't fix it. It's not meant to be fixed. It's like, if it dies, it dies." And we're like, "Okay." But as time passes, and I've been talking to some of the people who are more active back in the earlier days, you know, about how can we get more stuff? How can we get more stuff? People have suggested Jason's approach, which is just like, just get it and don't, you know, just run a wget or whatever and just get it and like don't, and then tell them later. Cause in the end of the day, it's better to have it than to not have it. You know, they may get pissed or something, or it may be like whatever, but we may not be able to show it cause they may not agree to our license and stuff. But in the long game, and we haven't done this. So just to say, but it is something that has been going on in the, you know, and are like, should we do that? Mm. So
let's reward him for persistence. Go ahead.
I actually had a similar question to that, but we've kind of discussed it. But maybe one thing I'll say is the Petra video that got erased reminded me of a Robert Rauschenberg piece called Erased de Kooning. Mm-hmm. And it's this artwork that is a drawing by Willem de Kooning that was erased. It's a blank piece of paper, basically.
Totally.
And I would say that the fact that it got deleted through this algorithm built into YouTube is essential to that piece. I think it's
true.
That's
kind of fulfilled by that.
So the artist created the algorithm that erased the piece. Is that right?
I don't think so. No. I think it was YouTube.
Okay.
Yeah, they have a spamminess rating. And she had like 200 or more tags that were just like dirty words, like random stuff, you know, and their spam bot was like,
But I actually had a different question too. And it's simple. What about GitHub? I mean, you guys may have heard about this security exploit that happened recently. There's a lot like at stake there in the software community. Are you guys working with them at the Internet Archive? Or?
Well, Archive team goes after a lot of things that we consider. We sit around and we ask the question, what would happen if this was gone, right? So, for instance, we downloaded Thingiverse. We downloaded Muammar Gaddafi's site 2 weeks before it was erased by people. We downloaded an Ethiopian news agency that was going away. We downloaded all these things where we just keep asking the question. Stack Exchange happened to make all of their items available. We immediately grabbed a copy and we immediately put it back up again on archive.org. Did the same thing with Usenet because Google screwed it up, you know, and we constantly ask the question, right? I mean, this is, you know, life insurance is essentially trying to convince people about actuary tables and to come to terms with their context in the universe that is not as awesome as they had hoped it was going to be, right? And it was, okay, you've got children, and have you thought about what's going to happen if you are not part of the puzzle? And the answer is often no. And this is what you should do. Here's your contingency planning. And a lot of websites and a lot of functionality we have out there is kind of shared, Git as Git does. So SourceForge concerns me. GitHub concerns me. Certainly a lot of these other websites. To some extent, Facebook's utter domination of all human expression in photographs, which it really is now, is very dangerous because they're a very sociopathic company. And it's a very strange place to store your things. And people are doing it, and that's fine, but there's going to be an awful wake-up call. And the thing is, this is asking non-trivial, non-intuitive questions. So a lot of it is just getting out the mind virus of, have you even asked these questions? And yeah, we actually have a tool we helped, we were sort of involved in, called Git Annex, Git-Annex. Git Annex lets you check things into Git without actually putting the items in there. Think of it as an indexer. You're using Git's ability to check in. So we checked in parts of the Internet Archive. So you can say, let me examine it using Git's tools. And that this is very technical, sorry everyone else. But basically what it is it's a way to turn websites and things out there into indexed files that you can then manipulate to say, I always want to ensure a copy of this is on my local drive and over here. And then we're working harder to make it easier and easier for people to do this. So you just join this hive and you five people guarantee the safety of this ongoing data. By doing this, we're leveraging all of this geekery and these skills to do things more than just ensure that your startup does this and this. We make sure that, like, you know, everything you're doing is in other places. Another place that's doing this, and I'm really sorry because I don't know the full name. If you look for A-N-I-L space D-A-S-H, Anil Dash, he and Gina Tremati and Annie Bale, they're working on a whole ThinkUp. ThinkUp is an example of providing you with the tools. They're a little clunky now. They're getting better. To go, I'm going to take back the responsibility. I'm my own IT department without all the pain. Parallel Flickr. Aaron and I were hanging out a little while ago about that because Archive Team's downloading all of the Creative Commons images on Flickr. Because why not? Anyway, what's your thoughts?
I'll do that real quick. We use Git, and we use GitHub too. I have Git on our dev server and GitHub as a backup. You know, as much as we kind of are talking about like worrying about these third-party services and stuff like that, if they didn't exist, we wouldn't be able to do the things we do.
That's true.
Because like you know, we're a small kind of ragtag group of people, and we depend on some third-party services to, you know. Dropbox helps us get stuff done so much better. And we get it off of Dropbox, but it's like we don't, you know, you can't reinvent the wheel for everything. Like, in, so you just kind of do what you can and keep what you can local, but, and I have updated all my SSH keys, so I'm not worried about that exploit anymore. But, yeah, so it's a two-sided coin where you figure it out.
Our angel in the darkness has made the symbol of ending. The darkness has come upon us. That said, we are all still available to talk afterwards. Please don't run away. Or do, but think of us often in your thoughts.
Yeah. Pray for us.
Keep us in your prayers and think about what we've said.
Well, thank you
and hard.
For coming out.
Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Really appreciate it.